And we are ready to move on to the third perek, the third chapter of Psachim, making some nice progress as we move forward here. And I will put it up here on the screen for us to look at together. Great. We're going to jump right in. Perek Shlishi. So we've done a lot of things about checking chametz and the time when you can eat chametz and when you've got to get rid of it. And then we went into some processes that have to do with when you generate chametz by just perhaps having things lie around. It's casual dress down Friday here. there's limits. We are now heading into some other Mishnayot that basically are dealing with when there might be something that's chametz that you might not be thinking of quite in that way for some of the different reasons that we'll see. So let's begin. Elu ovrim befesach. Kutach habavli, v'shechar amadi, v'chometza adomi, v'zeitom amitzri, v'zoman shel tzabaim, v'amilan shel tabachin, v'kolan shel sofrim. All right, so we have a bunch of things that literally pass through on Pesach, but in the sense of they are problematic to have around on Pesach. Either they should be gotten rid of, elu ovrin, they should almost like a flipping of the letters with Livaer, or you are supposed to get rid of them so they no longer exist. Might even also even be the language of, if you have these in your possession, you have done some kind of Aveira, you have done something wrong. Okay, but Elu Ovrim BaPesach, these things are problematic. And they include a whole bunch of things that have these interesting sort of nationalistic names to them. Things from Bavel and Madai, Edom, Mitzrayim, which are various kinds of things used for other functions. So some of them are actually food, right? Kutach is some kind of dairy-based dish, maybe some kind of yogurt or fermented thing, but that has some kind of bread or starch as part of its ingredients. Shechar Hamadi is some kind of beer that involves barley being soaked in water. Chometz Adomi is a certain kind of vinegar from the region of Edom, which also contained some kind of barley mixed into it. And Zeitom HaMitzri is another kind of seemingly intoxicating drink, which had some kind of chametz component in it. So these are actually foods, those first four. And it's sort of obvious on some level that they're chametz, but the part that's a little less obvious, and we'll see this when we get to the last line of the Mishnah, is, but they're not really chametz, right? That is to say, they're not 100% chametz, or they're not like risen dough. They are what later we'll refer to as ta'arovet, as opposed to chametz be'en, a mixture of chametz with something else that's primarily something else. So, right, we think of beer as being one of the most obvious things that's chametz, but if you think about it, beer is mostly a glass of water, right? It's just a glass of water with some chametz ingredients that then gives it its flavor. The Mishnah here is reminding us that the prohibition on owning chametz includes things that have at least a meaningful percentage of their total volume that is chametz. The Mishnah doesn't get into that, but the Talmud will get into what is that percentage. Does it have to be a seventh? Is it anything up to a 60th? We're not here talking about chametz's ability to forbid things on Pesach. You might say that, you know, an actual crumb of chametz that falls into something else on Pesach just forbids it no matter how small it is. That's the conventional halakha. We're talking about, though, before Pesach, what makes something chametz in the first place. And these things have enough of a character and components to them that they so count. Now, we go on to these other items, the zoman shel tzabaim. So here we have water that is with some kind of bran or some other grain mixture in it that is used by painters, okay, that they would use this as part of the substance they would use for painting. And you've got then butchers, tabachim, who are using an amilan, That's the modern Hebrew word for starch, but it's some kind of grain product that is not really used normally for food, but is used as part of their sort of seemingly absorbing some of the gross materials that a butcher might have around that they might need this substance to soak up, the same way starch and other substances might be used today for things that have nothing to do with food. You'll remember in an earlier Mishnah, we saw that putting wheat on a wound. So this is that sort of thing. And kolan shel sfarim is basically a glue that's made out of some form of flour, that includes flour, and would be used by sofrim, by scribes, to paste together some of the different papers and materials that they might be using. So these are things that are really not actually appropriate for eating, and yet they have enough chametz in them. And again, in later terminology, they would be ruim la'achilat kelev. They would be sort of sufficiently theoretically consumable, at least at the level that a dog might eat them, that they are still something that you have to be concerned about. As I mentioned last time or the time before, there's a kind of further extreme you might hit where you turn chametz into a piece of furniture, right? Or something like that, where it just becomes something totally different. But the line between a mixture of flour and water, which you might be designating for paste, but which really is sort of still in a form where it could be consumed, that's where the Mishnah here is mostly focusing us. This Mishnah and all the discussions around it obviously become the basis for them thinking about, do you have to worry about shampoo, medicines, all kinds of other things. And those will interact on the level of what's the percentage of chametz? Is it even theoretically in the realm of food? How much has it been totally designated for some other thing? And someone's asking about Play-Doh, and that would be exactly that kind of question where you might say that Play-Doh has sort of crossed over the line of this being in a totally different sort of a state. And the kinds of glues that they're talking about here is not like going and buying a bottle of Elmer's glue in the store, but things that are sort of interchangeable with other food items you might have around. And indeed, a scribe would not be able to work with that paste during Pesach, and I'd say beyond that, would not be allowed to own it. Elu Ovrin, one of the interpretations, Ovrin min ha'olam, you got to get rid of these things. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, perhaps playing with some of this liminal space, af tachshitei nashim, even some ornaments that women used to wear are also included in this. Probably this refers to some notion of, if you think about facials or other kinds of things that might use paste that might otherwise be edible, even though they're in your medicine cabinet, so to speak, but they're fundamentally in a form where they can still be recognized and perhaps even detected as chametz by at least an animal. Rabbi Eliezer says that too is over the line and a problem, though it seems that the Tanakama, the first anonymous view here, does not agree with that. And the Mishnah doesn't unpack exactly what the basis is there, but it may be that just it is too far away already from the world of eating for it to be anything that we're obligated to get rid of. Ze aklal, kol shehu mimin dagan, harei ze over befesach, harei elu be'azara ve'en bahen mishum karet. The general rule is, if something is made of dagan, is made of grain, then it is something that, again, is forbidden on Pesach or needs to pass away on Pesach, or if you held onto it over Pesach, is problematic afterwards. However, and here's the important point, these are be'azhara, which means they are included in the Torah's direct prohibition, the warning, literally, azhara, right, of lo ye'achel chametz. Chametz should not be eaten, and that includes these things, meaning the consumption of these things, or even the owning of these objects would be forbidden, min ha-Torah, on a biblical level. Nonetheless, they do not carry the karet penalty if they are consumed, okay? The karet penalty, ki kol ochel chametz v'nichrata nefesh ahi, that eating chametz is not just don't do it, but if you do it, there is a dread consequence of the penalty of karet, of somehow being cut off from the Jewish people in some way, however that gets understood. That only applies, the Mishnah seems to say, with something that is more purely predominantly and obviously chametz. So, you know, by the plain sense of this Mishnah, without getting into all the later places that halacha might take it, you indeed might conclude and say, for instance, to eat pasta on Pesach is a karet level offense, but to drink a glass of beer, while biblically forbidden, is not a karet level offense because it is essentially water. I'm not recommending anyone drink beer on Pesach, still biblically forbidden, but want to get a sense of the Mishnah here, as in many places, is trying to get to some degree of hierarchy, even within the world of prohibition, of what's the real serious core and what is the additional extension beyond that. Batzik shebesidke areva im yesh kazayit b'makom echad chayav leba'er ve'im lo batel b'miuto. So imagine a kneading bowl, and a kneading bowl you're definitely not going to use on Pesach. You can't use your chametz kneading bowl on Pesach. But I have a question of, do I have to throw out the kneading bowl? Assuming the kneading bowl is made of wood, do I have to completely sand it down? What do I do with the pieces of dough that are left in the cracks of a kneading bowl? Any wooden kneading bowl develops some kind of cracks over time, and if you are pounding dough into it, there's going to be some dough absorbed. Do I have to worry about it or not? And the answer here is actually no. That is to say, all you need to do is take the kneading bowl and put it away in the closet and not use it anymore on Pesach, but then take it out at the end, provided that there is not an olive's worth of dough in a single place. If there is an olive's worth of dough, so there's a little meaningful dimple in the bowl, not just a little crack, but a place where in a continuous fashion you could add up to an olive's worth of dough, that is considered enough chametz in one place with sort of enough integrity that you do not have to, you must get rid of it, right? Only if it's below that threshold can you say, yeah, whatever, those are little pieces of chametz scattered throughout the bowl, and I don't have to worry about them. Now the question is, wouldn't you just put it aside and sell it? So this is one of the many Mishnayot that indicates that people did not, as a matter of course, sell their chametz. The assumption is that, no, of course you got to get rid of all of your chametz, and the only chametz you don't have to get rid of is something that is basically below the threshold of being significant enough to be considered chametz that you are owning, right? And just the sort of this kizayit standard, just so we understand, if I have a jar of oatmeal in my closet. So if that's sitting all in one place, let's assume the oats are, you know, not totally raw and they have their chametz because they've been somehow treated with water along the way. If I have those oats, or let's go better, Cheerios, all right? I got a box of Cheerios and it's in my closet. So that is, I will be over bal yera'eh. If I leave that over Pesach, that will be a violation of owning chametz on Pesach. In theory, if I took those Cheerios and scattered them all around the floor, okay, such that they are each just individual little pieces of chametz dirt, each one of which is less than a kazayit, you're not violating owning chametz on Pesach because there's no one thing that's actually of that size. No one would really want to live in an environment like that. But technically, that's why you don't actually, for purposes of ownership, need to search out every crumb of chametz that might be in your house. In the kitchen, in places where you're planning to prepare food, so then you want to make sure there's not crumbs which could potentially contaminate your Pesach food on Pesach itself when chametz is radioactive in forbidding the food that we eat. But in terms of it being around the house, small items don't matter. And this Mishnah is an example of that. Anything less than an olive's worth in one place, you do not need to worry about. If it's not there, batel b'miuto. It's just considered to be an insignificant rounding error on the volume and character of the bowl. V'chein le'inyan ha-tum'ah. Im makpid alav chotzetz, v'im rotze v'kiyumo, harehu cha'areva. Now, there's huge debates over how to parse this Mishnah. Is the phrase v'chein le'inyan ha-tum'ah meant to go to the previous phrase, and then we start something new? Or is v'chein le'inyan ha-tum'ah meant to introduce the next phrase, but the next phrase is a little bit of a non sequitur? So I'm going to read it as introducing the next phrase as it's punctuated here, and how it's a little bit of a non sequitur, which is to say, so too, With respect to tum'ah, with respect to purity and impurity, there is a sense in which you can sometimes ignore dough in a kneading bowl. In Pesach, the way you ignore it is when it's less than a kazayit. When you're talking about impurity of a bowl and the question of whether I can immerse this bowl in order to purify it before removing little bits of dough that are stuck to it, we have a standard of, is it the amount of dough that you are makpidala, that you care about, you would normally remove before you used it again? Or if it's actually the kind of thing where I'm actually glad my bowl was developing some cracks and the little bits of dough that got stuck in there and have gotten caked up are actually making it more solid and more smooth. If it's the latter, if the pieces of dough stuck in the bowl are the kinds that I'm actually perfectly happy for them to stay there, then they have the status of the bowl. Meaning, when you immerse a kli, when you immerse a vessel, it must be completely devoid of obstructions in order to go into the mikveh and be able to receive the purifying power of the water on its surface. And the only obstructions that can be allowed on the surface are things that you are perfectly content to leave there forever, such that they become essentially a part of the bowl. So the Mishnah read this way would be, v'chein le'inyana tumah, similarly, when it comes to immersing an impure kneading bowl, what you're looking for is not, is the bowl completely clear? But you are looking for whether the bowl is completely clear of pieces of dough that you would otherwise be taking off. You're just too lazy to take them off before you go to the mikveh. Okay? The other way of reading the Mishnah is v'chein le'inyana tumah, so too with tumah, the amount that matters is a kezayit. And then there's a separate halacha about imakpida lav v'imrotze v'kiyumo. I'm not going to go through that full alternate reading, but it gives you a sense of both the Pesach rule and the tumah rule. Sometimes there's stuff that's stuck to the wooden bowl that doesn't matter and you can ignore it. Okay, now we move on really to an unrelated point, but still about dough. Batzek ha-cheresh, im yesh kayotze vo she'echmitz, hare ze asur. So literally, deaf dough, okay, which seems to mean dough that when you bang on it, okay, it does not actually generate any kind of sound, okay. That's one reading of it. Other readings read the word cheresh as sort of it provides you no particular information, the way that if you just tried to speak to someone who couldn't hear and neither you nor they had the tool of sign language, they would not necessarily be able to give you any information back. So too, this dough is not giving you information about whether it is chametz or not, okay? Meaning we're dealing with some kind of dough you've already made, and something has happened in its development where normally, all right, I mean, if you've ever baked bread, right, or proofed yeast and it sort of failed, right, like, or you're not sure if it failed, sometimes you make dough and the yeast is working, you can smell it, you can feel it, you know exactly what's going on. Sometimes you feel like, I don't know, it doesn't feel like it's rising so much, I'm not sure what's happening. But batzek ha-cheresh is basically where you've got some kind of dough where you are not able to tell whether it's risen already. How do you figure out whether you got to throw out that dough or you can still use it for matzah? If there is kayotsebo, if there is a parallel batch of dough to it that already became chametz, then you must assume it is asur, it is forbidden. So basically it's like, imagine you make a whole bunch of dough at one point and you separate it out into different batches. And a bunch of the batches already reach the chametz point. And then there's this batzek ha-cheresh, this dough that is not giving you any clear information as to its status, but it's been sitting there for the same amount of time. The Mishnah says you can't say, well, so it doesn't look like it rose, doesn't look like it fermented. No, you know it's coming from the same batch that a whole bunch of it already fermented. Therefore, you've got to assume that this did as well. All right, this is sort of also part of a larger question we talked about with the chardal, putting in the mustard, a sort of general feeling that with we've got an 18-minute rule that normally tells us how long flour and water can be together before they rise. But there are other factors that sometimes distort that. And to the extent you actually see dough that has risen, it doesn't matter if it's only been there for, you know, 10 minutes, that's still forbidden. Okay, we're gonna do one more here. This is an interesting case of an intersection of a couple different areas of halakha together. We had this with the Trumat Chametz and Shogeg and Mezid, combining Chametz rules with Truma rules. Here we've got that with respect to challah. All right, so background for this Mishnah. How does one remove challah generally? Okay, so you take out the challah from the dough that you are making, you take out a small portion, and you set it aside, or ideally in the time of the Mishnah, you would give it to a Kohen, you would give it to a priest, and they would eat it. Okay, great. How do you separate out challah on Yom Tov? So on Yom Tov, you are not allowed to burn things. You are not allowed to burn things that are not for the food. Well, that's before we get to burning. How would you separate out challah and Yom Tov? So in theory, you could give it to a Kohen, but if a Kohen was not available, right, in theory, what you would do is you just have to let the Truma sit there, right? You can't really bake it because you can't use it, but you just have to let it sit around. And at the end of Yom Tov, either it won't be fit anymore for a Kohen, or you could give it to a Kohen in its sort of extended risen state. But that's what you would do there. What do you do with challah bitum'ah? When the dough is impure, you still separate out challah so that you don't forget the idea that you're still supposed to, with every dough, cleanse it of its tevel state, of its untithed state, and give what's due to the Kohen. But no one can eat challah tme'ah, so you just burn it. And that's, of course, the common practice today when people still take challah, when there's no Kohen to give it to. You take that little piece off of the bread that you're kneading and you just burn it, you know, wrapped up separately, but you burn it in the oven. Now, let's say we've got challah bitum'ah v'yom tov. If it's challah that is impure, it's a dough that's impure and it's yom tov and you've got to separate it out. So then, for sure, what you have to do is just leave it sitting around all day. You cannot burn it because you cannot burn stuff on Yom Tov, cook things on Yom Tov that are not for the day itself, but it also can't be eaten by anyone. So it has to just sit there. That works fine if it's Shavuot, if it's Sukkot, if it's Shmini Atzeret. Just let the dough sit around and it'll become chametz, and who cares? But what do you do when you're baking bread, you're baking matzah on Yom Tov? You still need to take challah from the batch of matzah that you are making, but there's nothing to do with it. You can't burn it, and you can't seemingly let it sit around. Okay, so we have three fundamental approaches to this. Rabbi Eliezer, Ketzad mafrishin challah v'tumah v'yom tov. When you are baking matzah on the Yom Tov of Pesach, what do you do about the challah problem, assuming that the challah is tme'ah? It's from an impure dough, such that there's no way to bake it and give it to a kohen. So, how do you do it? Rabbi Eliezer Omer, lo tikra l'ashem ad sheteyafeh. Rabbi Eliezer says, the way you've got to do this is, you've just got to bake the whole dough. You just make the matzah. And after the matzah has been baked, you like separate out a piece of one of the matzahs as challah. You're normally not supposed to first bake the bread and then take out the challah. But if you forgot to take challah and you baked the bread, that is what you're supposed to do. Rabbi Eliezer just says, yeah, that's the rule you have to follow on Pesach. There's no other way to do it. So Pesach has a different rule where we tell you, bake all the matzah, remove the challah from the bread, not from the dough. And yes, the matzah would then not be whole. This is not necessarily the matzah for the Seder. This is some other additional matzah. And by the way, you don't have to take it from, right, what you can take challah from the whole batch. So you could bake 10 matzot and separate one of them out as challah. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira Omer, Tatil Bitzonin. No, what you do is you take that dough that you separate out from from the dough that you're baking, and they take out the challah dough and you put it basically in a container of cold water. And the idea is that if you put it in particularly cold water, it won't rise, right? Seemingly, you can just sort of almost put it on ice, though they're not saying to do that, for the rest of the day. Amar Rabbi Yoshua, lo zehu chametz shemuzarim alav beval yera'e uveval yimatze. Ela mafrashta umanachta ad ha'erev ve'im echmitza, echmitza. Rabbi Yoshua says, this is not the kind of chametz that we are warned to be careful about when the Torah says, you may not see or find any chametz in your possession. Rather, what does one do? One separates it out. One leaves it on the side until the evening. If it rises, it rises. Now, that ve'im echmitza echmitza seems to not be maybe it'll rise, maybe it won't rise. That seems to be a formulation of ve'im echmitza, which we know it will. Basically, we know that this dough sitting around all day will rise. But if that happens, not your problem. This is not the kind of chametz that we are concerned about, okay? So just go about your business. Now, this is an interesting question, how to read Rabbi Yoshua. A lot of the commentators try to read Rabbi Yoshua as making a sort of like reasoned, firm, legal argument that this chametz really doesn't belong to you, and therefore it is not covered by the prohibition on owning it. Therefore, it kind of gets to exist in your house as something that, yeah, you separate it out for the Kohen. It's the challah, even though the Kohen is not going to eat it. It doesn't really belong to you. Lo yera el chaseor. It just has to be something that really belongs to you. This is someone else's chametz. And therefore, there's technically no problem. There's an alternate way. I'm pretty sure Shama Friedman in reading this Mishnah suggests that this is actually a rhetorical way of saying, like, lo zehu chametz shemuzarim alav beval yera'e uveval yimatze is not a kind of hard and fast legal argument of I'll show you why this dough isn't covered. It's more of a rhetorical flourish of, oh, come on, that's impossible. It just can't be that the Torah commands this. That is to say, maybe even on some technical level, you are violating Bahirahu Vayimatse, or I can't tell you clearly how it doesn't fall into it, but there's no way that we can possibly make you stop baking bread, fresh matzah on Pesach, and therefore, this just has to not be your problem. There's no other way to think about it. Even to the point that Rabbi Yoshua is sort of rejecting the idea that you would take the challah out of order like Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Eliezer, or you would take some mitigating approach like Rabbi Yehuda ben Bateira and putting it in to cold water. This is just sort of the price of the fact that the Torah did not forbid baking on Yom Tov of Pesach. Means it clearly thinks that on some level you have to be able to do this, even if we don't have the clarity of why that's so, right? People are also saying it can't be owned by the Kohen. How can it be owned by the Kohen? So again, there's two ways of thinking about it. In the formal legal argument way, you can say, well, I don't own it. It's not my problem. And it's not the Kohen's problem because it hasn't been given to a specific Kohen yet. So there's no individual person who's on the hook for this. Right? It's almost like challah, the second you separate it out, is in a no man's land of ownership until it is given to someone who then ends up owning it. Or you can, again, take this sort of larger approach and say, yeah, it's not really the point whether someone's owning it or not. The idea is, ach asher yaseh lechol nefesh, hu levado yaseh lechem, when the Torah says you are allowed to prepare food for yourself on the first day of Pesach, so that obviously includes bread, and you must be able to make matzah. And since the baking of all matzah in significant quantities requires the separating out of challah, the Torah must be turning a blind eye to that problem in that context. That's two different ways. I'm sure different people here have different dispositions of how they prefer to read a text like that. I will just point out here throughout, if you paid attention, the verbs are all in the feminine form, lo tikra, tatil, and that too reflects something we saw in an earlier Mishnah. It's not that this is a gendered halakha per se, But the assumption is that it is women who are breaking this bread, and that the next Mishnah, which we'll get to next week, will pick up from that point. Also an important reminder that, yes, matzah was a daily baking activity on Pesach that average people did. This is something also perhaps not so simple with our current distribution chains, but folks who do already know how to bake their own matzah, it's maybe a year where you're doing a little bit more of that perhaps, but it was very much something that was done by individuals in their home. You have to learn the halachot, you have to be very careful, but it was something that was not restricted to a minuscule elite. I'm going to wish you a Shabbat Shalom, and I'm also going to note that this has been such a success and such a joy. We're continuing this on next week. The larger Hadar team is stepping in to make sure that this happens. Jeremy Tabak is going to kick us off for next Monday to take a bunch of the upcoming Mishnayot. We'll check in as we go to see how this plays out, who joins. It will be the same time next week at 1 p.m. every day, Monday through Friday. I encourage you to invite others to join. As you can see, you can join in for any given session, and we try to give people a little catch-up of where we've been. It would be great to grow this community of learners. Thank you so much, and Shabbat Shalom.